you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy Saturday, everybody. Since William Hogarth got a name drop in this week's episode on gin, we thought we would bring our episode on him out for today's Saturday Classic.
This one originally came out July 5th, 2017.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And today we're going to talk about an artist, but his story really involves so much more than art. It involves satire and social criticism, and it even gets into some legislation for artists' rights. But one thing we should point out is that his satire and social criticism was being made in the early 1700s, when the society he was criticizing was very different than ours.
It was debauched in a lot of ways.
Yes, so there are a lot of things that are viewed very differently than we view them. There is discussion of sex workers in this episode. Not any details, but they come up in some of his prints, as well as some violence, some drug use, things like that come up. So just be aware that that's in the hopper and that it will be, again, based on the views of England in the 1730s and 40s and 50s.
Well, and especially because our artwork for this one is a self-portrait of the artist with his dog.
And it looks so sweet.
It looks very sweet. And I was like, I could just see teachers saying, hey, this would be a great episode to share with the kids.
And it might be, depending on the age of your the kids right. You're thinking of, but you would want still, I think, to frame it and kind of listen first and decide based on the actual content. But we're going to talk about William Hogarth, who was an English artist that, as I said, his life story involves a lot more than just art.
Mm-hmm. William Hogarth was born to Richard Hogarth and Anne Gibbons in London, England on November 10th, 1697. He did have some siblings, although the tallies on those siblings vary wildly. Richard Hogarth, William's father, was a teacher and a classical scholar, and while he did have patrons, the family still struggled financially.
Yeah, Hogarth later in his life would talk about how his dad had really been treated very poorly and he ended up in deep debt. Some accounts say that his father went to debtor's prison, but I couldn't find a solid verification on that. But that does kind of inform some of his work going forward. And despite being the child of an educator, though, William was pretty disinterested in formal education. He was really smart and he was curious, but even from a young age, he was more inclined to draw than to study texts. But it seemed that his father was not exactly sure what to do to help William find a path in life that would suit his interests. He wasn't against him pursuing art, but he didn't really know what to do with it. So William ended up looking for an apprenticeship. And this is another time where I will say there are some accounts that suggest that his father was in debtor's prison and he had to get the apprenticeship, and others that say that he just knew his dad was not going to be much help in finding him a career path, so he went and found one himself.
At 15, he became a silversmith's apprentice and he learned engraving skills. But his master in this position might have hindered his development by giving him a mediocre instruction. And Hogarth, once again frustrated that his mentor's guidance was really lacking, opted to seek out information about the trade on his own. So he was augmenting this kind of weak training that he was getting with self-guided study.
And during his apprenticeship, Hogarth studied the world around him as much as his trade. He was definitely a fan of all of the various entertainments offered by early 18th century London, from theaters to bawdy houses to coffee houses where intellectuals gathered. He sort of was one of those people I always think of as like a student of life. Like, he just wanted to go around and see people doing all the things that people do and learn from that.
When Hogarth was 23, he opened his own shop. In that same year, he started taking formal drawing classes. But the normal curriculum for drawing lessons, which was sketching live models or prepared tableau and attempting to replicate other artists' work, had the same effect on Hogarth as his early attempts at his education had. He was not interested. He found it frustrating and limiting, and he had turned to drawing school to expand the possibilities of his engraving work. But he didn't think the classes were actually going to help him achieve that goal.
And so he opted, once again, to rely on himself for his education, and he began to train his observational skills because he wanted to be able to draw real-life subjects from memory. So he developed his own improvisational style over time, and simultaneously he was supporting himself through his regular engraving work.
That work included projects like book illustration, so he was getting some practical experience in commercial art, but this was not particularly fulfilling. He would later say that the work, quote, did little more than maintain myself in the usual gaieties of life, but was in all a punctual paymaster.
And it wasn't long, though, before he found himself attracted once again to drawing school. But this time it was a little different. It was a school housed in the home of Sir James Thornhill.
Thornhill was an accomplished artist. He had been the official history painter in the courts of George I and George II, and he had been knighted in 1720. He was also a member of Parliament. He painted in the Italian Baroque style, and Hogarth was a fan of his work.
And part of the appeal of studying under Thornhill was the fact that Thornhill had achieved a level of social standing that was unusual for an artist. He wasn't toiling penniless at the whim of a patron, although he was at odds with the neoclassical revival that was underway at the time.
In an effort to gain favor with Thornhill and make clear that he felt they were of the same mindset regarding art, Hogarth even published an engraving at the time titled Masquerades and Operas, which was a criticism of the trend to embrace foreign art above the art that was actually created in England. The engraving features, among other things, a fool and a devil leading a crowd into the theater to see the latest popular entertainment while a woman with a wheelbarrow carries away all the writings of Congreve, Dryden, Otway, Shakespeare, and Addison.
And below the image is the following inscription. Could new dumb Faustus, to reform the age, conjure up Shakespeare's or Ben Jonson's ghosts, they'd blush for shame to see the English stage debauched by fooleries at so great a cost. What would their manes say should they behold monsters and masquerades where useful plays adorned the fruitful theater of old and rival wits contended for the bays?
A copy of this engraving, which is known as the Bad Taste of the Town, is in the British Museum's collection. And while it's not on display, it is digitized and available online, and it will be linked in our show notes.
Yeah, I feel like with all of Hogarth's work, we should mention that it's worth going and looking at it for yourself, because we can describe it, and we will for a couple of them describe them, but they're very busy. There is a lot going on in every single picture. And that's part of his social commentary that he includes things. And it's kind of like you will never fully grasp all of the sort of intensity of these very, very detailed pieces until you actually see them for yourself. So I encourage you to go look for them. And publishing masquerades and operas had long-term ramifications for Hogarth's life and career. So the criticism of England's contemporary art and culture scene and the connoisseurs in it, of course, earned him a number of enemies. And most prominent among them was the architect Richard Boyle, who was the third Earl of Burlington. He and others would kind of have this rivalry with Hogarth for the rest of his life. And it was not the first time in his early career that he would butt heads with art patrons.
After several years of study with Thornhill, Hogarth believed he had learned enough that he should begin a painting career in earnest. One of his first patrons was a tapestry maker named Joshua Morris, who had requested a painting from Hogarth. And when Hogarth delivered the art, Morris refused to accept it, claiming that Hogarth had not finished it and that it was apparent that the artist was really an engraver and not a professional painter. William Hogarth then sued Morris for his money and brought a number of expert witnesses to the trial, including Thornhill, to attest that, yes, the work involved was a complete painting and that Hogarth should be paid the money that he was owed. The court found in Hogarth's favor.
Yeah, I think this is a time when artists were not so willing to really, like, pursue legal action when someone said, oh, no, I don't want that painting after all. But he did. That will come up again in a little bit, that he's willing to take legal action for his rightful money. Also in 1728, Hogarth painted his first dated painting. Up to this point, he had produced some plates and other things, but they didn't have dates on them. And this is The Beggar's Opera. And it was a recreation of a scene from a current production of the farcical play. And it was an example of just how well he had trained his memory to recall detail. Because apparently, according to many people, he basically perfectly recreated the scene as it had played on the stage, even though he had, of course, gone away and painted it later. He actually ended up painting 5 different versions of the scene.
In 1729, Hogarth and Thornhill's relationship took on a new dimension. William became Thornhill's son-in-law when he and Jane Thornhill eloped.
And in his early career, Hogarth became known for paintings known as conversation pieces. And these were portraits of small groups of people depicting them in a casual, informal moment, like they're having a light conversation. And these also tended to be physically small paintings. And as Hogarth's conversation pieces became popular, they did afford him a degree of financial success. But he also started to find them really boring to work on. And this was in part because each individual piece didn't really bring in all that much money. He was a very quick worker, but he had to basically keep cranking them out at a rapid pace to keep money coming in.
But even as he continued speedily cranking out these conversation pieces, he also worked on other projects for which he had greater enthusiasm. And these pieces were humorous, realistic scenes. And like masquerades and operas, these works often skewered social trends and preached morality. If they had been published as sequential art on a page, they would look very similar to comics in style. But they came out as full-size prints, each one taking up an entire page of its own. And this was where he truly hit his stride as an artist.
Yeah, this is really what made him famous and what continues to make him sort of an important figure in the art world. And he was very savvy about the success that started to come with it, so much so that it did, as I mentioned earlier, lead to some legislation. We're going to talk about all of that in just a moment, but first we will pause and have a little sponsor break.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whereas Hogarth's conversation pieces offered him financial stability, his moral satires brought in a great deal more money, so much so that he reached a point where he really had financial independence. He could work on the things that he chose to do rather than depending on commissions or patronage to meet his ongoing financial needs.
As prints of Hogarth's engravings were made to sell to a wider audience, he was aware of the risk that copycats could plagiarize his work. And that is because that had happened to him. He published a very popular series called A Harlot's Progress in 1733.
And the six paintings, which were then adapted into plates that made up A Harlot's Progress, were produced at a time when the topic of prostitution and sex workers were the focus of a lot of attention in London. In the late 1720s and early 1730s, there was this effort on the part of city officials to bring morality back to London's streets by working to eliminate or at least reduce the obvious appearance of prostitution. But out of the initial vilification of women that this sort of charge started, there was this secondary wave of characterization of women sex workers that made them seem more like innocents who had been trapped by corruptors. And this was a debate that was going on in papers throughout London at the time. And Hogarth's engraving told a tale along the lines of that second characterization of an innocent who falls into this life through no desire of her own to pursue it.
In the first plate, an innocent young woman named Moll Hackabout arrives in the city from the country, thinking she'll make her way in a trade such as dressmaking. But she's intercepted by a brothel keeper named Mother Needham, who is shown assessing Moll's attributes. In the second plate, Moll has become a kept mistress living in luxury, but then she's caught cheating on her keeper.
And by the third plate, Moll has been cast out by that keeper and has become a prostitute on the street. And in plate four, she has been imprisoned for that. In plate five, she is once again a free woman, but at this point she has an illegitimate child and she is dying from a sexually transmitted disease. Plate six is Moll's funeral, attended by women who also work in the sex trade and men who appear to be more interested in taking advantage of those women than in mourning the dead person before them, Moll. Even the parson in that final plate has his hand in the skirt of one of the other mourners.
Because of the popularity of A Harlot's Progress, fake copies were produced all over London by seedy printers hoping to cash in on Hogarth's work. And naturally, the artist was incensed, so much so that he took legal action.
So, of course, it was not really feasible to chase down all of the various printers who had been making unlicensed copies of these popular plates. So William Hogarth, along with several other artists, went to Parliament, and they made a case that their work should be legally protected. And after hearing the artist's case, a piece of legislation called the Engravers Act was introduced in 1734, with language that would protect engravings that featured original designs. And it was signed into law on June 25th of 1735, and it became known by the nickname Hogarth's Act. You'll sometimes also see it written as Hogarth's Law.
While the Engravers Act was in legislation but not yet assigned law, William Hogarth actually had another series that he was ready to publish, but he was not willing to do so until there were legal protections in place to prevent pirated copies from circulating.
And in the meantime, Hogarth's mentor and father-in-law, Thornhill, died in 1734. And after the loss, Hogarth decided that he would reopen Thornhill's drawing school, which had never been a particularly successful venture. Hogarth's version became much more of a salon where artists shared ideas and discussed their work.
Once the Engravers Act was law, Hogarth released the series he had been withholding titled A Rake's Progress. The series, like A Harlot's Progress, was painted in oil first and then adapted as a set of print engravings. The rake in this narrative is Tom Rakewell, a young man of leisure.
In the first scene, young Tom has freshly come into his fortune as his wealthy and apparently miserly father has died. Tom, wasting no time spending his newfound money, is being fitted for a fancy new suit while simultaneously paying off a paramour who appears to be pregnant and heartbroken. She will appear in later plates as well. In scene two, Tom is surrounded in his home by an assortment of people all vying for his attention and his financial favor.
By the time the viewer sees Tom in the third scene, he has fully descended into a life of debauchery. He's in a brothel, taking part in an orgy, and this is a good time to mention that in Hogarth's works on morality, even though sexual situations are conveyed, there's no nudity, but there is the suggestion of it. So to modern eyes, the plate three looks like a wild party. It might take a moment for the viewer to actually register exactly what is going on.
Yeah, he is taking part in this big thing, but it's not overtly portrayed. Once you start seeing the clues and you realize, like, oh, people's hands are in each other's clothes and stuff, but it's not quite so graphic as you might be envisioning. And in the fourth scene, Tom is about to be arrested for the debts that he's accrued in his debaucherous lifestyle when that same young woman from the first plate that he bought off steps in and she pays the bailiff all of her money so that she can save him. And in the fifth scene, Tom is getting married, but not to that kind young woman who saved him though he had wronged her, but instead to an elderly heiress in the hopes of regaining a fortune in the match.
The sixth image is a seedy scene. Tom is in a gambling den. The room is on fire, but neither Tom nor the other gamblers notice because they are so absorbed in the fortunes that they stand to gain or lose. Tom appears to be pleading to God for assistance in his bet.
And Tom is pictured in debtor's prison in the seventh image in the series. He has written a play in the hopes of selling it to make some money. It's kind of sitting to the side. And his wife is pictured, that same woman that he married for her money, but at this point she is gaunt and clearly not the wealthy woman she once was. And the final scene shows Tom in the Bethlehem Royal Hospital, known colloquially as Bedlam, where the insane and impoverished of London were sent. And he is naked at this point, save for a ragged cloth that's draped over him. And a wealthy woman who has come to see the spectacle of Bedlam looks on. She has paid for admission to come and sort of observe the lower creatures in this horrible condition.
This particular series was popular when it first appeared, and it's remained so in the centuries since. In 1935, the story of Tom Rakewell was adapted into a ballet. It became a film in 1945 and an opera by Igor Stravinsky in 1951. The original painting series of A Rake's Progress was purchased at auction in 1802 by the wife of architect Sir John Soane. Today, they are part of the Sir John Soane Museum collection. Unfortunately, the original paintings for A Harlot's Progress were lost in a fire in 1755.
Yeah, and A Rake's Progress, there have been even more modern adaptations and other works inspired by it. But those are sort of the key points where in the more modern age, it suddenly had this resurgence of interest. And both of these series of works, as well as others that he worked on during the 1730s and 1740s and some in the 1750s, are filled with these details, like I mentioned before, that add to the story. And in some cases, they make direct social or political commentary. Like in some cases, he'll have pieces of art on the walls in the backgrounds that have meaning. And some of the people that are depicted as supporting characters in these works were actually well-known figures of London at the time. Sometimes they are cast in roles that make it clear that William Hogarth did not think very highly of them.
Not long after the release of A Rake's Progress, Hogarth was elected as one of the governors of Britain's oldest hospital, St. Bartholomew's. He contributed to the decor of the facility by painting two large pieces for the main staircase, which were the historical paintings Pool of Bethesda and the Good Samaritan.
Yeah, that hospital was founded, I believe, in the 1100s. And we're going to talk about the unique legacy of those two paintings there. But first, we're going to pause for a word from one of our fam sponsors.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because, God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if... No. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source, and iHeart Podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into what lies beneath the glitzy image of Hollywood's golden age and all the sex, money, and murder that's been swept under the rug for decades. Using the Variety archives, each episode offers a rare glimpse into little-known casting couch stories that have long lived in the shadows. So join us as we navigate the tangled web of Hollywood's secret history with host Tracy Patton, along with expert Variety reporters and correspondents, as they discuss the secret history of the casting couch to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Those paintings in St. Bartholomew's, which are often mistaken for murals because they take up whole walls, but they are in fact canvases, are still in the hospital today, and they have taken on sort of a unique role. In addition to acting as massive decor, the figures in those paintings are 7 feet tall, so extrapolate from that how big, like, full scenes featuring people that size would be. They are also used in a really kind of interesting way as teaching tools. It's believed that Hogarth used patients from the hospital as his models for the paintings, and he captured their illnesses pretty accurately and without exaggeration. And as such, the characters in the paintings are sometimes introduced as topics of diagnosis discussion with medical students. Hogarth's subjects display conditions which could be myotonia congenita and rickets and syphilis and gout, among others. And so it's kind of an interesting way to test and develop observational skills, which I think is just sort of fantastic. To go, hey, what do you think this person in the painting has?
While these two large-scale historical paintings are not considered to be Hogarth's best work, they are an important part of the hospital's history because they are in an active space. They need constant upkeep. In his lifetime, Hogarth covered the expenses to do so himself. He also requested that the two paintings never be varnished, though at some point that request was disregarded. Repeatedly, during a cleaning of the paintings in 1937, layers of varnish were carefully removed.
And after his work on the St. Bartholomew's Staircase project was complete, Hogarth turned to more traditional portraiture. And one of his first portraits in this period was a painting of philanthropist Thomas Coram, which he displayed at an orphan's hospital that Coram had founded. And he also convinced other artists to donate their work to the hospital when it was completed in 1745.
His famous self-portrait, The Painter and His Pug, was created in 1745. And that same year, he released another series called Marriage à la Mode. In the exhibition description of Hogarth's work at the Tate Museum in 2007, it was described as follows. The satirical thrust of Marriage à la Mode is as much about patronage, aesthetics, and taste as it is about marriage and morals. Over and above the title itself, Marriage à la Mode includes Italian and Dutch old masters, French portraiture and furnishings, Oriental decorative arts, an Italian castrato singer, and a French dancing master, a turbaned black pageboy, a masquerade reference, a bagno and an aristocratic toilette, and even syphilis, which Lord Squanderfield probably contracted abroad and was popularly known as the French pox. Thus, his emasculated and diseased body is additionally emblematic of the spread of, quote, foreign culture that has infected and weakened British identity, society, and commerce.
And I wanted to include that because they so perfectly kind of encapsulated in that one paragraph a lot of the way that his art worked in terms of how it would take people down with these little subtle clues about, and not so subtle clues about what was going on in the picture and the people involved. So the story of Marriage a la Mode is that of an arranged marriage, which leads to a life of idle distance between the couple involved and extramarital indulgences, both in terms of affairs and just debaucherous behavior otherwise, including drug use. So for Hogarth, who married for love and really seemed to have had a happy match with Jane Thornhill, marriages arranged for financial benefit seemed both ludicrous and doomed.
The late 1740s and early 1750s saw a shift in Hogarth's worth back to prints, but they were more basic images intended for mass market sales. He didn't start with paintings for those prints, but from drawings. One of these series, titled The Four Stages of Cruelty, is a commentary on how unkind children can easily become violent adults. It depicts animal abuse in the first plate, and then the main character, Tom Nero, becomes progressively more a monster, culminating in a macabre final scene in which the hanged Tom is being dissected for an anatomy lesson in the surgery.
Yeah, that was one, I will confess. There are debaucherous and sometimes unpleasant images in all of his work. That series really, I found quite troubling. The animal abuse is really graphic, and then the things that sort of happen as this character becomes more and more of a lost person and a violent person are really surprisingly affecting to me for plates. So if you go looking, just know that that's the case. At the same time that he was working on these simple morality prints, Hogarth was also painting, but he had reached this point where he was starting to struggle to finish any of his canvases. He actually staged two auctions of his work between 1745 and 1751, but these led to both frustration and embarrassment because they did not generate enough interest to really bring in much money.
In 1753, William Hogarth published a book titled The Analysis of Beauty, in which he laid out his principles of beauty and focused on the import of what he called the line of beauty, an S-shaped curve that's inherently appealing and exciting to the human eye. The book met with mixed reviews and was mocked by his detractors.
Yeah, as we mentioned earlier, early in his career, he made enemies, and he stayed that way for the rest of his life. In 1754, Hogarth produced another satirical series. This was known as the Election Series, which is a critique of electoral corruptions as told through a narrative detailing a political race in a fictional town called Guzzledown. And this series, which once again began as oil paintings and then was made into etchings, so he had gone back to that after he had started doing the quicker drawings into etchings version, skewered both the Tories and the Whigs for bribery and corrupt practices. And the first painting in the series actually went on display several days before the general election that year, at a time when election corruption was being discussed in every paper in London.
In 1757, Hogarth became sergeant painter to King George III. But despite this prestigious and well-paying position, his later years were really marked with disappointment. In 1759, he painted Sigismunda Mourning Over the Heart of Guiscardo, which features the title's heroine holding a goblet containing the heart of her husband murdered by her father. The criticism of the work was severe, and Hogarth did not paint much after that.
Yeah, there are some write-ups of that piece saying that he was trying to prove that English painters could produce work exactly as good as the Italian masters, and that the reception was more of like a, I don't think so. It did not go well. And he did make one other political statement with his anti-war print series titled The Times, which he did after that, which made a rather unpopular statement in coming out against the Seven Years' War. And at the time that that series was published, the war had not yet ended. So it was like in year six and did not have the name the Seven Years' War yet. People were outraged by this particular work, and politicians who supported the war vocally and publicly criticized Hogarth, and it only served to dampen his interest in his work.
Hogarth's last artistic endeavor was an etching titled The Bathos, or Manner of Sinking, which was published in March of 1764. It's often described as having an air of doom in it. In it, time is depicted as a winged figure broken and lying prone amid an assortment of debris, a puff of air escaping his lips with the word fini printed on it. The image was intended to be the tailpiece for bound collections of his work, and when considered in that context, it's a little bit less ominous.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a death and destruction kind of image. But when you consider that it would be the end paper of a book where they're saying the book has ended, it seems a little less upsetting. But people will sometimes hint that it was maybe a portent of his upcoming death. So a few months after the bathos was created, in the summer of 1764, William Hogarth had a seizure, and he remained quite ill from that point until his death on October 26th of 1764. And he was 67 at that point and had been working as an engraver and artist for more than four decades.
Today, not only can you find Hogarth's works in museums around the world, but you can also visit the house he lived in from 1749 until his death. It's now a museum, and we will link to information about it in the show notes.
Yeah, William Hogarth. He's a fascinating creature. He's one of those artists, like usually I will wax rhapsodic about artists and kind of fall in love with them. And I was telling Tracy before this, I don't know how I feel about him. Like if I think he would be a delightful, fun person or if he might be a crabby stick in the mud. I'm not sure. But some of his work is really lovely. Yeah, so most art historians and critics will say, like, if you look at his satire pieces because of their composition and what he included and how sort of rich and lush they were, those are warranted as the things that make him famous. But if you just compare, like, his straight paintings to other painters at the time, he's fine. But like not particularly a big standout, and you wouldn't be like, wow, he was really amazing.
Yeah, I saw some really interesting things that were about him trying to make it acceptable for anything to be the subject of art instead of just appropriate things being the subject of art.
Yeah, a lot of that came from that sort of bucking against the established art society in the early 1700s that he thought, like, that's foolish. Nobody should control what should be art and what shouldn't be art and what's valid art and what isn't, which I completely get behind. But yeah, he's an interesting chap.
Thanks so much for joining us on this Saturday. Since this episode is out of the archive, if you heard an email address or a Facebook URL or something similar over the course of the show, that could be obsolete now. Our current email address is historypodcast@iheartradio.com. Our old How Stuff Works email address no longer works. And you can find us all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.